From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. A recent report questions how well North Carolina's Medicaid program detects waste, fraud, and abuse. You'll hear highlights from the report, along with reaction from state lawmakers. North Carolina is already making preparations for the next round of Military Base Realignment and Closure, also known as BRAC. You'll learn details. Now that Charlotte has calmed down from the riots that followed the fatal police shooting of a black man, authorities at the local and state level are looking into law enforcement's response to the incident. Plus, you'll learn about the latest developments involving access to public records held by state government. Will a new governor lead to changes? Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Governor Roy Cooper has begun his new administration with more limited authority than his predecessor, Pat McCrory. The changes are the result of legislative action taken just a couple of weeks ago by the General Assembly and signed into law by McCrory in his final days in office. To look at what's ahead for the new governor, we turn to Becky Gray. She is Senior Vice President for the John Locke Foundation. Becky, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
First thing is, people may not realize that the power of the governor actually can change. Why is that?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's defined in our Constitution, but along many things, the governor's role is determined by the General Assembly. And they can change things, they can take things away, they can add things, and they have over the years. You know, we've heard accusations in the last week of this special session and what happened is unprecedented. It's the first time in history this has ever happened. All of that is untrue. It has happened many times over the course of history where the General Assembly has changed the rules and responsibilities, authority of the governor's office, and they can do it. That's how our Constitution is written.
And that's why sometimes we hear folks like yourself say, well, we have a very strong General Assembly and we have a weak governor, meaning the governor's seat itself.
Right, the governorship. Yeah, right. And that's not a reflection on anyone who has served as governor, of course. But the structure of our government is that more of the power lies with the General Assembly. And Donna, that's common throughout southern states. Interestingly enough, when they were set up, the plantation owners, the big landowners that were controlling government, wanted to ensure that they had a louder voice than one person sitting in the governor's office. So this is historical that we've seen. All of these things that we've seen, it's very interesting and it makes for great talk, and I'm glad folks are paying attention. And talking. A lot of people reading their constitutions again, which is great.
We love that.
Right, exactly. But none of this is new.
Let's talk about one of the most interesting changes, I think, and that has to do with the cabinet appointments that Governor Cooper will make. He's going to have Senate approval of those folks.
Right, and our Constitution says that the governor may choose agency heads with the consent and approval of the General Assembly. So although that has not been formally in place in past years, it is now, and it is written out in our Constitution. So what this means is Roy Cooper is determining who is going to be the Commerce Secretary, the Department of Administration, Department of Revenue, all of those offices, his cabinet, if you will, the head of those will have to have Senate approval. Now, Roy Cooper's got authority to hire a lot of people. So even if the Senate doesn't approve someone, who's actually doing the day-to-day work will probably be maybe the second in command that Roy Cooper has full authority to appoint whoever he wants. So it sounds like it's a bigger deal than I think it actually is.
Well, speaking of all of those positions that he will have the authority to appoint, there were some changes there as well. There's about 425 spots that Governor Cooper will be able to appoint whoever he wants. They are political appointees, but that is a reduction from the McCrory years where he had 1,500. But our own Mitch Kokai points out that 425 is actually more than former Governor Perdue had.
Right. So it goes back and forth. I guess the question that we ought to be asking is just how many government appointees does the governor need?
And who are these people?
Yeah, who are these people? We don't know. Of course, they're state employees. And some of these people are the, you know, obviously the people who work in the governor's office. Governor Cooper is going to want to have his own state budget director. He's going to want to have his own appointment secretary. He's going to want to have his own chief of staff. I mean, for obvious reasons.
Sure.
He needs to be able to hire those people. Now, what the General Assembly said was the reason, because they changed it when Governor McCrory came in to 1,400 appointees that Governor McCrory had, they said he needed more of those because he had such a big job of fixing broken state government. Now that many of those things have been fixed, they've reduced it back to actually more where it was before McCrory took office. But again, this is one of those things that the General Assembly has full authority to do this, and we've seen the ebbs and flows. It's gone both ways. I'm not sure how this is going to work. To be honest with you, Donna, as a regular citizen, as a regular taxpayer, somebody who's dependent on government services, I don't know that you're going to see that much difference. This seems to be somewhat of kind of an inside ball game struggle. Well, you know, we'll see how that goes. But, you know, again, the number of governor-appointed state employee positions has been rolled back, not as far as it was when Governor McCrory came into office, but it has been rolled back.
There's also going to be some interesting interactions over the next month having to do with University of North Carolina campuses and the boards of trustees for those organizations. Tell us about the authority that Governor Cooper will have when it comes to members of those boards of trustees.
Well, because the General Assembly passed this bill, he will have no authority at all. They have taken that away from him. So and this is not the Board of Governors. This is the Board of Trustees.
Individual
at the different. Yeah, so this is East Carolina University, Pembroke University, UNC Asheville, you know, all of the UNC member universities. The boards of trustees for those colleges will no longer be appointed by the governor.
Now, there was also another change as part of this House Bill 17, as it was known, had to do with the changes in the relationship and authority of the State Board of Education and the Department of Public Instruction.
This question of the role of the superintendent of public instruction, who is a statewide elected official, and the state board of education that is appointed by the governor has always been in conflict. There's a lot of confusion about who does what, who works for who, is the CEO of our public school system, if you will. There have been lawsuits that have been filed and litigated through the years. And so, again, this is not really anything new. It's just further clarification of exactly what does that role as the superintendent of public instruction. What is the authority? What do they do? What can they do? And how does that work with the State Board of Education?
And who makes the policy?
Exactly. Who makes the policy? And I think the thing that's important to those of us who are taxpayers and citizens of North Carolina is how do we get the best education system out of this? So I think those are the questions that they're going to be working through. And hopefully what we'll have is the continuation of these real reforms we've had in education that have greatly improved the quality of education and the opportunities that are available to our school children across the state.
Lots more choice over the past several years.
Yes.
Now, we also had some changes in several state agencies. There's been some consolidation that has taken place after the General Assembly met just before Christmas time. And so now Governor Cooper will have some different agencies to deal with. This has to do with the State Board of Election and Ethics Enforcement.
Yeah, and Donna, it goes a little bit further than that. Even it's also the lobbying division that is currently under the Secretary of State and also campaign finance. So if you think about these things, ethics, elections, lobbying, and how much money is going into our campaigns and lobbying, of course. This is all going to be under one state agency. I think this is a great idea.
Sounds like it's all related.
It's all related. And also what they're trying to do is move it sort of in its own separate entity away, as much as they can, away from the political influence of those things. I think this was one of the best things that came out of the short session that met in December.
Now, we also have some changes that will be reflected in how the North Carolina Court of Appeals hears cases and the number of cases that might be going through that body and the number of cases that might end up in the highest court, the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and what they did in this legislation is they put another step in that process. The way that it worked before this law passed was as a case was litigated through our courts, it went before a three-judge panel at the Court of Appeals, and if there was an appeal from that decision, then it then went on to the state Supreme Court. What we have now is another step in there where the next step after a three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals, it will go to the entire Court of Appeals. I call that en banc, E-N-B-A-N-C. It's a Latin term that lawyers know what they mean. For us regular folks, it means that it goes from a three-judge panel to the entire Court of Appeals and then will go to the North Carolina Supreme Court.
So lots of changes underway for new Governor Roy Cooper. Becky Gray, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
North Carolina lawmakers head back to Raleigh. There's a new governor in town. Working together or working against each other, they'll make big decisions. Decisions that affect you, your wallet, your home, your business, your kids' education. To keep up with those big decisions, day by day, even minute by minute, look to Carolina Journal, a full team of reporters and analysts. They're watching the action in the state capitol. They're reporting minute-by-minute developments for you. Carolina Journal. It's available each month as a free newspaper and every day with updated stories at carolinajournal.com. You'll find us on Facebook, too. Share items from Carolina Journal. Share items from the John Locke Foundation. Follow us on Twitter, at Carolina Journal, at John Locke NC, and at Becky Gray. Carolina Journal, it's your go-to source for news about state government and how government affects your life. Visit CarolinaJournal.com today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Medicaid is a multi-billion dollar program in North Carolina. Those who run it should be watching for waste, fraud, and abuse, right? A recent report from the General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division suggests the results don't look very good. Evaluator Chuck Heffron summarizes key findings.
During the three-year period ending June 30th, 2015, the number of fraud referrals by the Program Integrity Section declined by 84%. Program Integrity Section expenditures for contracted claim payment oversight services exceeded associated savings to state funding requirements by $3.2 million in fiscal year 14-15. Medicaid oversight of claim payment processing is not providing effective deterrence against fraud and may adversely impact access to services. The oversight of recipient eligibility determinations performed by the counties is not effective. And the results of oversight activities performed by the Program Integrity Section are not being used to improve Medicaid program operations.
So Heffron and his team have four recommendations for state lawmakers. Item number one.
The General Assembly should require the North Carolina Medicaid program to develop and implement policies and procedures ensuring available resources are cost-effectively used to identify and prevent fraud, waste, and abuse. To help ensure that the program integrity section cost-effectively uses state funds, the General Assembly should require the Medicaid program to develop and implement policies and procedures to ensure use of a uniform methodology to identify and measure the severity of Medicaid eligibility determination and claim payment errors. To ensure the cost-effective use of all available claim and eligibility review information, the General Assembly should also direct that the methodology be made available and used by other state entities performing Medicaid oversight activities when feasible. In addition, the General Assembly should require that counties are provided with incentives to ensure the accuracy of Medicaid eligibility determinations.
Item number two involves groups outside the Medicaid program.
The General Assembly should direct the North Carolina Medicaid program to work with its partners to identify alternatives to increase recoupments of identified claim overpayments and to more effectively prosecute fraudulent activity. Specifically, to help ensure the cost-effective use of state funds, the General Assembly should require the North Carolina Medicaid program, in partnership with the Office of Administrative Hearings and the state's Medicaid Investigations Division, to identify alternatives to increase the amounts recouped from identified overpayments and the number of fraud referrals accepted for further investigation and prosecution.
Program evaluator Chuck Heffron also recommends better oversight in the Medicaid program.
The General Assembly should require the Medicaid program to develop policies and procedures to ensure oversight activities cost-effectively address identified noncompliance. To help ensure actions imposed upon Medicaid service providers are appropriate, given the potential noncompliance, the General Assembly should require the Medicaid program to develop and incorporate a progressive corrective action process for providers selected for enhanced oversight. At a minimum, the process should ensure workloads are targeted, specific, and prioritized to realize an adequate return on investment of available resources.
The fourth recommendation involves a paper trail.
The General Assembly should require the Program Integrity Section produce an annual performance report and work plan which documents results and provides a plan to reduce fraud, waste, and abuse. The annual report should document the achievement of associated performance targets for each measure. The General Assembly should also require the Program Integrity Section to produce an annual work plan identifying the most cost-effective allocation of available resources. The composition of planned oversight activities should be established from the results of an annual risk assessment. At a minimum, the risk assessment should identify specific Medicaid participant and medical service categories, and for each category include consideration of established risk factors.
Dave Richard directs North Carolina's Medicaid program. He responded to Heffron's report.
I've been involved in multiple of these evaluations since I've been at the state, and we've always found that the process itself worked. And although you're never happy when people criticize you and what you're doing inside your agency, but we believe that it moved forward. Our objection, if you look through the most of the things inside of that letter, is really about the process. The findings that came from that process we think are somewhat misleading. We believe, though, that the outcomes and the recommendations for changes are things that we are on the same page with. We might have a little difference in wordsmithing. We might change the way we describe those. But they're all good recommendations, and we believe that we can work with the General Assembly to move forward. We responded, though, in such a length of time because we think it's important for the folks that work inside the Medicaid agency, for the public, to know that the things that are happening inside the Medicaid agency are continually attempting to improve the work we do. We take fraud, waste, and abuse very seriously.
Republican State Representative Craig Horn reacted to the reports and to the Medicaid program's official response.
Undoubtedly, Mr. Richard, we're all desirous of the same outcome, efficiency, economy, and excellent service. And the recommendations from PED are those that are met to assist in accomplishing those goals.
Senator Ralph Hayes offered some historical perspective along with thoughts about future changes in Medicaid.
Issues with the Program Integrity Unit at DHHS is nothing new to the General Assembly. I believe it was 2 years ago we actually required the department to bid out the entire Program Integrity Unit to private entities. I think they fumbled around for a few months, put out an unworkable RFP, and said nobody met the qualifications, so we don't have to do it. That's coming in, and so we still have a Program Integrity Unit. I would say counter to the will of the General Assembly that is centered at the Department of Health and Human Services. Secondly, but I do think some other things to look at with the Medicaid reform, 30 months from now, or maybe with the results of the election, 20 months from now is more what we're looking at if it's block granted. We have a program system that now means program integrity be responsible for determining did we pay the PMPM, the per member per month payment, for the recipient. And this follow-up for services and all that will go to the prepaid health plans, whether they're MCOs or they're regional providers. That's all changing. I think we've long had a sense that we don't do that well and monitor that well. and the insurance companies and the limited management entities will be able to handle those issues much better than we can as a state. So in drafting a situation with these payments, I think we also have to look at, we're talking an 18-month timeline to where the whole system changes again. I'm not saying we don't address it, but I think we very much have to keep that in mind.
You've been listening to Debate About Improving Detection of Fraud, Waste, and Abuse in North Carolina's Medicaid Program. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina is looking ahead to the next military base closing process. It's called BRAC. And State Military Affairs Secretary Cornell Wilson offered lawmakers a recent update.
The Air Force and Army are the most desirous of some sort of BRAC because they're reducing their troops. The Army is going down from 560 to 450, 150,000 soldiers. Yeah. The Marine Corps has stabilized at about 182. They want to grow some more, but I don't think that's going to happen. In the Air Force, they actually want to increase their numbers a little bit, but not much. But the easiest way to meet the budget demands is by reducing your personnel costs. And so they've done that very aggressively. And when you look at trying to also fight a war at the same time, you got to put money toward the war effort, and then anything else is going to be tiered down. So I think the... it's kind of hard to say what's going to happen in the future. We have a new administration coming on board. We think that it's going to be some, we got to keep our head to the ground and understand what the tea leaves are like and make sure we can address what's going to happen in the future. I think we got good, our base in North kind of pretty solid. Fort Bragg obviously not going anywhere. It might just be a reduction in numbers. You saw the 440th go away already with the the airlift wing out there. Camp Lejeune stayed pretty stable. SEMA Johnson, one runway, and that could be a concern. But they get a new KC-46 tanker, so that's going to be helping them out a little bit. And then also the Cherry Point with the new Joint Strike Fighter coming there, that should help them as well. So we'll see probably some numbers draw down a little bit more. I'm not sure how much, but I think we're going to be pretty safe as far as base being able to stay viable.
When might we see the next BRAC?
DOD has repeatedly stated that they will have some sort of BRAC or ask for a BRAC eventually, and that has not happened. It's been put into the budget to see what kind of effectiveness is still left in the bases themselves. But they have 30% excess capacity in the bases in the states. So the BRAC fund allows you a valuable analysis of the installations in our state here, understand what they are facing, and find ways to help increase the military value of those bases.
What kinds of things is North Carolina considering?
Trying to minimize the impact of big development in those areas around the bases. When you can't train like you want to, then they'll move those bases someplace else. We don't want to lose any bases, and it's easy to move aircraft to another base. We want to make sure they can fly over the right low-level flight routes down the Deer bombing range, practice their craft, and be able to fight and win our wars.
State government has devoted money to BRAC preparations. Wilson's department is seeking more.
We're going after a $1.6 million grant to study the businesses around the communities that are affected by the drawdown in our DOD dollars. And this will allow us to be able to help those companies be able to redirect their efforts towards something that's going to help them stay and sustain themselves throughout the future.
That's Cornell Wilson, North Carolina's Secretary of Military and Veterans Affairs. He's discussing preparations for the next military base closing process. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Charlotte made national headlines for all the wrong reasons when a fatal shooting involving a police officer led to riots in the streets. Now that the city has cooled down, city and state officials are assessing law enforcement response to the event. Charlotte Mecklenburg Deputy Police Chief Jeff Estes recently testified before a state legislative committee. It focuses on emergency management. Estes discussed what happened on the night of the first protest following the shooting.
We believe that we have that situation contained, and then came the power of social media. If you haven't grasped the power of social media in our world, it's time that we recognize that. One singular Facebook live blog post started and perpetuated the events that unfolded afterwards. Some of the things that we experienced, the tactics of the demonstrators / protesters changed from this event from ones that we had seen in the past. In the past, police were allowed to, or we determined the disengagement. So if we engaged a riotous crowd, we could normally in the past have determined when we could disengage, and it allowed us tactical advantages. In this case, the crowd continued to push all through both nights of disturbances. They would not allow a disengagement, so we had to tactically disengage, which in our world requires a little bit more maneuverability for us. The movement, it is one thing for us to police a crowd of 300 or 500. It's much different to try to police 50 groups of 10 spread out along a big geographical area, and that's what we experienced here. It effectively divides the resources that you're trying to police.
The protests started on a Tuesday. They turned violent. Estes picks up the story.
Tuesday night was the first signs. On Wednesday night, to give you an idea of scale, we stood up, without going into specific numbers, multiple hundreds of officers in response. And even then on Wednesday, because of some of the aforementioned, we still had property damage and, unfortunately, another homicide that took place within the areas of protest. So by Thursday, once the request for resources from the state was made, I can stand here before you confidently and say that there was no cleaner way it could have been done. The resources were allocated, deployed, and given without question. It was, in my view, fairly seamless. In 25 years of being in this business, this response was one of the best, actually the best that I had seen.
How did the situation change on the third night of protests?
We were able to combat some of the tactics that they were using new this time, which is up on interstates to interrupt interstate commerce. We were able to hold critical infrastructure in place and then allow for more mobility to be able to take care of the protesters as it went through. As a result, in many other places that you've seen around the country, protests lasted weeks. Here, we had two nights of true civil disturbance, two. We take that as a mark of things we did right. We wish none of it had taken place, but for us, we count that as a mark of success.
That's Charlotte Mecklenburg Deputy Police Chief Jeff Estes testifying in front of a state legislative committee. Lawmakers had questions about the Charlotte riots. Senator Norm Sanderson wanted to know about punishment connected to rioting and looting.
You guys were in a national spotlight, and you handled it, to my understanding, very, very well. I guess the biggest concern that any law enforcement agency has that was put in that predicament is what happens or what do you do when a protest morphs into a riot? And which is something that you have no control over. You just have to respond to it. My question, I guess, is, what really disturbs me more about a riot is the looting and the damage that takes place during that under the cover of a protest. Do departments generally do any follow-up after things have calmed down? The only way I see to prevent that or to put some kind of a prevention in place is to go after these folks who participate in that and really kind of make make an example of that you can protest, but when you cross over that line, then the law is really going to go after you.
Absolutely. I can't speak for other departments. I can say for our department, it was our mandate that any bit of video evidence that we had of looting or assaults, we followed up on, and we made, 30, 40 arrests in the weeks following. So every piece of video we got, just to give an example, we had a gentleman who we got on surveillance video who was looting, who turned up a little while later, I think on the national media with the same shirt on with his name at the bottom. So we were able to follow up, sign warrants, and make an arrest on that individual.
Representative John Faircloth wondered whether law enforcement agencies might be able to make better use of an existing state law.
For a long time, I've been sort of preaching in the in a room where nobody was listening and saying that we don't make enough use of our conspiracy laws. It's one of the most powerful laws we have. It's very seldom ever used, and it is impossible for two or more people to commit a crime without having talked about it and planned something. So in every case, virtually, whether it's involving five wrongdoers or whether it's involving 5,000, there are conspiracies involved. And the power in a conspiracy law is that those who join into the action later are also guilty of the conspiracy, even if they weren't in the planning phase. So I think it's incumbent upon us to try to help you and the law enforcement community and the district attorneys and others involved in reaching out and finding some of these people who, not those who are trying to protest legally. Everybody has a right to protest. But when the original plan goes further than just protest, and there are plans made along the way to do some damage or hurt some people or whatever the case may be, those are the kinds of things that, until we give the message out that we're not going to tolerate that by bringing some people to justice, we're going to be facing the same problems over and over again.
State Senator Ronald Rabin wants to see that lessons Charlotte police officers learned can be shared with communities across North Carolina.
The thing is, all the intel we can gather is good intel. It helps prevent more of the disaster to continue and so forth. With all that you learn from this experience, I would think that the Triangle folks could benefit from it, that Lillington and Sanford down in my area could benefit from it. Is there an effort being made to bring this together? Maybe you guys would be involved so that everyone can share the lessons and everybody can learn and make everything a little bit better.
The answer, according to the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Deputy Police Chief, is yes. You've been listening to a legislative discussion of lessons learned from the recent Charlotte riots. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. A three-judge panel of the North Carolina Court of Appeals has dismissed an appeal from former Governor Pat McCrory's administration. It was a legal dispute with media outlets and two left-of-center nonprofit groups. The dispute was over access to public records. Now, the panel's ruling specifically rejected McCrory's argument that appellate judges could consider supporting the then-governor on the basis of, quote, sovereign immunity. So exactly what does that mean? And now with a new governor in office, Roy Cooper, what should the media and public expect when it comes to government transparency? Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal, a longtime veteran journalist himself, and he joins us now. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
The McCrory administration had argued sovereign immunity. Sounds very official. What is it?
Well, it's a provision in the law that applies to most acts by public officials in their duties as public officials. They can't be sued as individuals. For instance, if the General Assembly passes a law banning firearms in a certain area, then the people who signed that law, if the law is challenged in court on Second Amendment grounds, the people in the law who signed the law can't also be challenged as individuals because they were acting as in their capacity as public officials. Otherwise, you could never pass any law that upset anybody because everybody would be in court all the time. And so this is a provision in the U.S. Constitution that also extends to the state constitution, which basically says people who are public officials are allowed to do their jobs. And as long as what they're doing when they're doing their jobs isn't breaking other laws that would be illegal outside the public sphere, then they can't be taken to court.
What did that argument have to do with the issue of public records that apparently had been requested from the McCrory administration?
Well, part of the lawsuit was filed. Part of it was actually a test to see how transparent the McCrory administration was going to be, because there had been complaints by a number of public organizations, nonprofit groups, and media organizations, including Carolina Journal, about delays in receiving public records from various departments of the McCrory administration over the years. And what part of this was testing, okay, one thing that happened was some of these groups involved sent records requests to a number of cabinet-level departments and then to the governor's office itself. And many of the agencies complied to these with these requests in a matter of days, if not weeks. But the governor's office itself waited months, if not longer, to comply with these requests.
I believe at one point the McCrory administration had argued that they were just overwhelmed with requests and that many of them were just frivolous requests for records.
That's correct. And the argument that we, among other organizations, made was that, well, that's just part – that's the cost of doing business. If you're in business serving the public, then your business should be public and it should be available to the public, and you shouldn't necessarily have to have a large printing press or a large number of donors or anything like that to get access to the records. They're open to everybody. Anybody in the state, or basically anyone at all, should have access to these records and should have access to them quickly, because the law says they should be provided as quickly as possible.
Now we have a new governor, Roy Cooper, entering his first days in office as our governor. What is his history of transparency?
It has changed over the years.
Interesting.
For years, he served in the General Assembly, and he was one of the major advocates of openness and transparency in government. He was involved in helping to develop a circular that's still distributed by the North Carolina Press Association on open government, on public records and open meetings in the state. And he also has received a number of awards from different media groups for his transparency, his record of transparency, when he was in the General Assembly. Then he was elected Attorney General in 2000 and served there for 16 years, and has been pretty much of a black hole when it comes to getting information from him.
Why is that?
It's really, really tough for them to do anything other than if you're making a request for something that he didn't want to talk about. Let's say if he wanted to promote some initiative he was working on, then he was very accessible. But if you were asking information, typically the response from his spokespeople would be, we're considering this. This is a matter that's possibly in litigation, and we can't comment at this time.
Didn't we actually have a media organization sometime in the last several months report on a public records request that they made to the Cooper office as Attorney General, and they found quite little, actually?
Right. They found that he had somewhere in the teens number of emails that he had actually sent under official accounts during his 16 years as Attorney General. So that's really not a lot of activity, even if you consider that email has only been used frequently for about the past decade. So it's a really, really small amount of information. And he had one role as in the legislature, and he's had a completely different role in the executive branch.
Well, now he's governor. So what would that portend then for access to finding out about communications over potential policy disagreements or anything going on within the governor's office?
Not a good sign so far, that's for sure. In fact, when the General Assembly was meeting in special session back in December and making several moves that limited the governor's power, the governor-elect called a very hasty news conference, gave almost no notice whatsoever, and we attempted to cover it. Our managing editor, John Trump, went to the office of the Justice Department, tried to get in, and was excluded.
Why?
Because he wasn't really given a reason. He was just said, you can't go. It was interesting because Carolina Journal, basically, and all media organizations attempt to get credentialing. They get permission from the executive branch and from the legislative branch and judicial branch to cover events. And 2 days before this press conference was called, I actually had made a formal request through the Attorney General's Public Information Office to be credentialed and to get on all the media mailing lists for events and things like that. So it was not as if he was walking up there out of the blue and nobody knew that he might be coming to this. So he'd actually made a formal request, for which I got no response. And after John was turned away, I sent a rather testy response saying, what's going on here? This is outrageous. And again, have heard nothing. And this is now, we're going on weeks with
no
response.
So as of the point you and I are talking, you have communicated with his office twice.
Yes.
And still no response.
Have had no response whatsoever. That's right.
Rick, people might be wondering exactly what is a public record?
Well,
what do we as citizens have the right to see?
Pretty much any communications that takes place under the color of activity that a public official engages in. So, for instance, if a public official sends an email to someone on a public website, for instance, or a public email server, so that happens. That's a public record. If a person is involved in a meeting with a public official and there are any official notes taken, those notes are public records. Any correspondence on paper that's made is a public record. Anything that's done as far as finance is concerned using public money is a public record. And even there is the question, because this happened during the Easley administration where he was using a private email account to conduct public business. If you're using a private email account, but you're using it to actually set policy or converse with other officials, then it should be considered a public record also. And it only has to have essentially one public person involved in it. So there's no such thing as private one-way conversations with public officials when they're doing official business.
Now, of course, Carolina Journal is a reputable, credible news organization. But let's say that I, as a private citizen, want to find out what the governor was talking about on a particular issue. Do I have the authority or the right to request records as an individual?
Yes. And they're supposed to be complied. The request is supposed to be complied with quickly. And it's also supposed to be at a nominal cost to you. The way that the interpretation has been in the past is basically what it would cost to get it photocopied at your local copy center should be as much as they would charge you for records. They can't charge you for staff time. They can't charge for things like that. And they have to turn them over as quickly as possible.
Fair to say that you're going to be pursuing the Cooper administration to make sure that Carolina Journal is credentialed and allowed into these news conferences and activities with the new governor?
Oh, we're going to do the best we can to keep on top of this.
All right. And, of course, we'll have you back to talk about the new governor's administration as we go through more discussion about policy and the future of North Carolina. Rick Henderson, thank you.
Thank you.
Rick is the editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal, carolinajournal.com. Well, that's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.